This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, I'm thinking of ending things. No, not personally. That's the name of the new movie that Matt Olien is reviewing. And we are also going to hear from news director Dave Thompson as he stops by for his weekly news debrief. And we are also in our spring member drive. The number to call to invest in this service is 800-359-4145. You can also click and join at prairiepublic.org. I'm joined now by Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota and the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. The upcoming May episode is this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central as they discuss the philosophy of consulting. Jack, though, we want to have you talk before that about the philosophy of donating to public radio, because, of course, it's here for free for some people, right?
Prairie Public is the most fun I have every week. Now, I don't know if that's sad or not, but nevertheless, it's absolutely the most fun. And it is also the most informative. I learn so much from public radio. I learn so much about the region. I learn so much about national and international news. And also, it's a challenge for me because between Why Radio and being on Main Street, I have to explain things in ways that are sophisticated but accessible to everyone. And that's the great challenge, and that's the great pleasure.
Well, I love that term, sophisticated but accessible, because that's what we aim for on a show like Main Street. I don't need to know everything about every topic. What I need to do is find a guest like Jack Russell Weinstein, who can talk intellectually, who can talk thoughtfully, who is absorbed in the field, who is passionate and engaged. But then also there is this extra level of not just using all the same language that, you know, you probably wrote about, Jack, in your doctoral thesis, and you use that to defend that to a bunch of other people with philosophy doctorates. But then you go and you listen on the radio, and there has to be that accessibility component. We love having a guest like that on Main Street who can tell you what you need to know in a way that also is easy to understand. You are supporting that when you call or text the word donate to 800-359-4145 or when you click and join at prairiepublic.org. Donations today are being matched dollar for dollar thanks to our member challenge fund. We have some extra special members who have said that they will donate more to try to get other people to start or maybe increase their donations. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org. Now, Jack, talking about the Why show, the philosophy of consulting, and I got to listen to this episode already, and in the introduction, you made a number of the same points that I was sort of thinking about too, that when we talk about business, we're thinking about profits. And when we talk about philosophy, we're thinking about ideas. And I can see why some people would think those are mutually exclusive. Why did you want to tackle this intersection?
Consultants are the philosophers of the business world. Now, I just want you to think about that statement for a second. First of all, I think it's true, but also think about your vision of what a philosopher is. Think about the idea of someone who thinks deeply, decontextualized, is interested in the great questions. And now think about the business person who's only interested in product, who's only interested in moving forward, you know, for their own benefit, who's only interested in making money, in exploiting others. And now try to combine the two. And what you get is a very, very interesting problem solver who is both concerned with people and the process, who is concerned with the ethics of the situation, but also the practicalities. And that's what made this conversation so exciting, because it challenged not only both my conceptions of philosophy and business, but also it allowed me to see how what I do is really useful in a whole different context, and that the skills that I teach my students and the skills that I strive to have myself can be used for profit, can be used for nonprofit, can be used to solve problems in the workplace, and can be used to explore how curiosity is a precondition for helping a business succeed.
I was really struck by the conversation, and I've been noticing this increasingly in my life, from everything like when we say living a yogic lifestyle or perhaps a religious lifestyle, or even just something like the Marie Kondo, the woman who does the life-changing magic of tidying up, and she's the one who wants you to hold up your shirt and say, does this spark joy? And you only keep it if it sparks joy. And it sounds so silly. And even on some level, saying like having a good yoga practice can sound sort of silly for how to live a better life. And in the same way, a business consultant, I think it sounds a little bit silly to say, well, what is this person who isn't working in my field able to do in my field? But it seems to me they all come down to examining if what we're doing aligns with our values.
I think that's right. And I think that even more than values, what is our purpose? Mm. All of the things that you articulated, whether it's the yogic lifestyle, whether it's religion, whether it's Marie Kondo, all of these presume that we're trying to accomplish something. Maybe it's being well-balanced. Maybe it's personal redemption. Maybe it's having more pleasure and minimalism in our lives. Once you have that mission, then you can decide what a good path or a bad path is, and you can have a conversation about what is an ethical or an unethical action. And so what a consultant does is ask a business, what's your mission? What are you trying to accomplish? What do you do different from other people? What do you bring to the table that isn't redundant, right? Mm-hmm. Just that question, right? Mm-hmm. What do you bring that other people don't offer? Because so much of what we see in the world, so much of what we see in commercial society, in fast food restaurants and products on the shelves and in clothing stores, is just the same thing over right. and over again. And so what a consultant can do is say, look, if you want to succeed, you need to stop thinking just about yourself, but you need to think about how you best organize yourself and how you make decisions so that you can help others achieve or acquire what they want. And that's a really interesting idea. And against, I think, the vision that lots of people have about business, businesses work if their mission coincides or overlaps with the mission of their customers, their clients, and even their workers. There's a harmony there, and a consultant helps people find that.
So did you get the sense, is his process, you know, going in and asking kind of the same set of questions and giving tailored advice, or does he end up needing a different process depending on what business he's consulting with?
Well, let me say, first of all, that the guest, Bob Colleran, is one of my dearest friends. And we actually developed a course together called The Ethical Consultant, which was a very, very interesting challenge for me. And Bob is, and I will say this on the record, Bob is one of the smartest people I've ever met. He's really amazing. And I think this comes out in the conversation. So what he is able to do is walk into a circumstance and use his toolkit, as he would call it, to assess what kind of critical thinking is required and what kind of questions he needs to ask for the particular circumstance. So he's going to be himself. He's going to be direct. He's going to be sometimes challenging. He's going to have the goal of giving truth to power. But at the same time, he's also going to recognize in this circumstance, we have to be concerned with these sorts of questions. And in this other circumstance, we're going to have to be concerned with other sorts of questions. Because the other thing that he really brings out in the conversation is that business is people. Right, that when you are trying to solve a problem for business, you're not talking to the HR software, the human resources software, and you're not talking to the assembly line. You're talking to the people in the business. And so you're facing interpersonal problems. You're facing self-interest conflict. And you're also facing habit and myopia, right? Such a precise focus on what you're doing that you can't see the larger picture. And so he's going to walk in and he has to not only assess the business problem, he has to assess the social problems as well. And so because he's very good at his job and because he's very smart, he's able to balance those things and bring a kind of process expertise to the situation. He is able to show people how to create a process that will allow them to do what they want to do while being ethical and considerate and efficient and maximize their profits.
So when you say something like process expertise, it's how to create that business to work at the highest end of its ability. Does that mean a consultant should be able to consult on anything from roasting coffee to designing swimwear? Or do you need different consultants who have some content expertise?
It really depends on the circumstance. If you are working, and he gives an example of a company that produces, I think it was thin metals, he's going to have a PhD, a doctor of I think it was chemistry, come and talk to them, right? He's going to have content specialists. But if what you're interested in is the mechanisms by which you manage the corporation or decide on the mission or deal with staffing issues, then you have a process expert. So there really are two different kinds of knowledge. There's the fact knowledge, the content, and then there's the procedural expertise. And let me give an example that actually ties into the pitch that you made earlier. One of the things that makes public radio special is that all of the people who are committed to it are assume that it's that the audience is capable of learning. And we're much more interested in creating an environment where people can learn for themselves than just telling facts. If you just tell a person facts, they don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to process it. They don't know how it relates to other people, and they lose their agency, right? They become passive. But if you teach people how to learn, if you assume that people are capable of figuring things out on their own, then you give them agency, you allow them to be a full person. And from what I understand with Bob, there's a parallel there. He's not going to come in and he's not going to say, here is the solution to your problem. He's going to say, let's have a conversation. Let's look at all the variables and let's create a circumstance in which you are able to discover the solution to the problem yourself.
So he's being a good parent.
Yeah, well, he actually refers to it as a border collie.
Okay.
He describes himself as a border collie. He mentions it in passing in the episode, but he describes himself privately all of the time. And what does a border collie do? A border collie, you know, runs onto a field where people are all over the place and then circles and circles and nips at their heels, you know, occasionally until they get into not just a clump, but an organized clump walking in the same direction. And I think that's what a consultant is best at, right? Is getting all of the people who are engaged in a particular project, who are all over the place and looking at all different things, eating grass in the different part of the field, right? And getting them to walk together towards a particular goal. And again, sometimes that means you have to nip at their heels. Sometimes that means you have to be a little assertive. Mm-hmm. But when it works best, everyone is doing what they want to do, but they're doing it, again, in a coordinated and harmonized way.
There's so much of being a consultant that sounds a little like you need to be a best friend, you need to be a therapist, you need to be the good cop and the bad cop.
Bob calls it a trusted advisor. Mm-hmm. What you need to be is someone who has the expertise and has the interpersonal skills so that when you disagree with someone or when you want to show them that they're making mistakes, that they believe you, that they don't conflict with you, that they say, look, you know, here is a good person that we have hired to help us see our blind spots. And yes, it's not what I thought the answer was going to be. And maybe it's even a little, you know, oh, my God, will my colleagues think that I'm stupid? Right. But I'm going to trust them. And again, think in your life, Ashley, how many people you have who are genuinely trusted advisors? How many people in your life would you call up and say, I'm having this serious problem. It's difficult. I'm having an emotional reaction. Help me figure out what I'm going to do. The mm-hmm. number is very, very small, right? Mm-hmm. I think for all of us, the number is very small. So the consultant plays that role in the business world of someone who you could call up and say, look, we have a problem. And sometimes that problem is a very specific technical problem that you need advanced knowledge, expertise, degrees, experience. But sometimes, again, that problem is a process problem. You've lost your way in the conversation. And I think consultants do that very well.
Jobs like that are always hard to set a fee for. It's kind of like determining what a brand is worth or how much art is worth, because it's not easily quantifiable metrics. Do you guys discuss at all just the philosophy of setting a price for the value that you bring, more so than the hours that you bring, for example?
We don't talk specifically about, you know, billing, right? We don't talk about Bob's billable hours,
right,
although
I will
say that, you know, they're pretty high, and his donation to Y Radio by appearing for free is a significant donation, right? So donations are good, right? But we do talk about that there is a conflict of interest inherent in all consulting, in that you want people to hire you again, you want people to hire you for more hours, and if you tell them what they want to hear, they're more likely to do that. Yet a consultant has to be honest, and a consultant has to disagree when it's important. And so one of the reasons why you need an ethical consultant is you need someone who is going to look at that conflict of interest in the face and say, I am going to do something in the best interest of my client, even if it means losing money myself. Mm. And again, how many people do you know that would sacrifice their personal interest for being honest? How many people do you know would even who are, you know, comfortable enough with conflict that they're going to say, you know what? I think you need to go a different direction. That's what makes the more experienced consultants, the more valuable consultants.
Right. It would be nice of me not to tell you if you have spinach in your teeth before you give a presentation, but it's not very kind.
That's right. And that's, you know, if I put on an outfit, you know, the other day I had a shirt and pants on, and I was a little unsure, and I asked my daughter, who has much more fashion. Well, that it's the pandemic, right? A shirt and pants is impressive. Thank you for acknowledging that. But I asked my daughter, did these match? And she just said, nope. And I'm like, I'm glad,
right?
Because someone was going to see it. And so this too ties into the consulting question, because what someone says at the moment may be a little painful, but in the end, what you want is, if in terms of an outfit, to look good, to look your best, to have something that's flattering and whatever the context and appropriate, whatever the context.
Right.
And what you want out of a consultant is someone who's not interested in the emotion at the moment, but rather the long-term consequence of giving good advice. That's going to feel unpleasant at moments, but in the long run, his clients are going to be very grateful.
And just very briefly, the concept of productivity, you know, a business person would say productivity means you are increasing sales. You are, you know, making something faster. A yoga teacher might say it's productive to rest and to stop doing and to start allowing. How does Bob Colleran look at the word productivity?
Well, certainly he recognizes that when he works with for-profit organizations, that productivity, efficiency, end product is very important. And you want to maximize that because you want to maximize the money. But at the same time, he also recognizes and talks to his clients about sometimes productivity has to be put aside in order to ask whether you're producing the right thing, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to slow down in order to ask whether you're doing it the right way. So let me just use an example that doesn't come up in the conversation, but let's say you have a very inefficient assembly line and you have to fix it, but you have to spend 2 weeks with the factory closed in order to do it. Sometimes you have to shut down the production in order to make better production. And a consultant can say, you know what? Now is a time for pausing and reflection, not a time for acting.
Now is a time for pausing and reflecting, and not just for acting. But what about if there's time for both? For our members, you can pause and reflect on the programming that you hear, absorb it, understand, learn, feel more connected. And then there's a little bit of time for action. As you pick up that phone or text the word donate to 800-359-4145 or click and join online at prairiepublic.org. It is a simple process, but it makes a big difference. Jack, I love what you were talking about when you were saying people lose their agency when they don't feel involved, when they don't have buy-in in the process. Well, I think it's fair to say that involving yourself in this process can increase your sense of buy-in.
By donating to Prairie Public, you are not only committing to, but you are helping support a region-wide conversation. What other channel allows people from all corners of North Dakota and the surrounding areas to be part and parcel of the same discussion? But in order to have a discussion, you have to listen and you have to talk and you have to create the circumstances that allow the conversation to happen. And that's what donating does. Donating says, I want to participate, but I also recognize that I can't participate if it doesn't exist. And donating helps us create the scenario and create the circumstance that allows everyone in the region to be part of the same conversation and to do it in a constructive rather than a destructive way.
And we love thoughtful, well-informed, engaging conversations and discussions. We have them every single day on Main Street. It is an absolute privilege that I have a platform like this, and I do take in mind that with that privilege comes great responsibility. And I'm very thankful that I am given the time to research, to listen to a whole podcast episode, to read a whole book before I talk to the author. And it's only possible because we prioritize time. We prioritize content. We prioritize the finished product on public radio. 1-800-359-4145. You can call that number or you can text the word donate, or you can also click and join at prairiepublic.org. Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota. The upcoming episode of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life airs this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central as he and Bob Colleran discuss the philosophy of consulting. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Ashley, being a part of Prairie Public is the thing that I am most proud of in my career. So thank you for having me, and thanks for allowing me to be part of the pitch to help people support Prairie Public.
Well, if you didn't already have a doctorate, we'd give you an honorary doctorate. Also, we can't do that, but
still, I'll take what I can get.
Still to come on Main Street, we have a movie review with Matt Olin, and we have our news discussion with Dave Thompson. But now it's time for today's news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Parts of South Central and Western North Dakota could see some precipitation this weekend. The National Weather Service says it may linger into Sunday. Todd Hamilton is with the National Weather Service in Bismarck.
It looks like a good portion of West Central and Southwest into South Central North Dakota could see a half an inch or more through Sunday. So late tonight through Sunday. And again, most of that will be falling late tonight through Saturday afternoon, early evening. and then lingering light rain through Sunday.
Hamilton says there is still some uncertainty about this system.
There's going to be a sharp cutoff of where that eastern edge actually is. So if it has been wavering back and forth a little bit, but it's pretty definite that there's going to be a sharp cutoff, whether it's like Minot to Jamestown or Williston to Bismarck. Once that eastern edge is defined, it's pretty much going to be dry east of there.
The Weather Service says there is still a chance of a thundershower in southwestern North Dakota tonight, with the possibility of a little snow mixed in for Saturday morning. A teacher is on administrative leave in the Wahpeton School District pending the outcome of an investigation after the school learned earlier this week there was a reenactment of the George Floyd arrest and murder in an elementary classroom. School Superintendent Rick Jacobson says the district doesn't tolerate any activity that would make students uncomfortable and considered as inappropriate and insensitive.
It's just one of those things that started, and it was hard to stop the snowball effect, but we got to it, and there is definitely truth to what went on. It should have been an activity that could have been a very good teachable moment, in our opinion, was not handled right.
Jacobson says details will be released once the investigation is completed. He says further information will be discussed on Monday. And XL and MDU are working with the North Dakota Public Service Commission on how to spread the cost of natural gas that spiked during the February cold snap in the southeastern United States.
With wellheads freezing, natural gas prices spiked.
Commissioner Brian Crosius says the cost to MDU would be around $80 to $100 per customer, and for Xcel, it would be more than twice that. He says both utilities have presented plans to spread those costs over several months.
It is, I think, a part of a growing concern in terms of natural gas pipeline infrastructure in the United States overall, the ability to move gas to market, and then pricing impacts when you have extreme weather events, which the system realistically should be designed for. It should be designed in such a way to handle those extreme events.
Russia says there's still more discussion that needs to be had on pipeline infrastructure. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, hearing that teletype machine means it's time to check in with News Director Dave Thompson, who joins us from our Bismarck studio. Dave, thanks as always.
Oh, my pleasure, Ashley.
So as it gets a little bit nicer out, people, you know, they already have cabin fever, spring fever at a time like this. And then you throw in something like a pandemic and people are real excited to get outside and see people. And now there are some loosening restrictions across the area.
Right. And talk about Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is kind of loosening a lot of the restrictions about outdoor gatherings. And he's going to end the mask mandate very soon. He said he'd end it sooner if they got to a certain percentage. I think it's 60 to 65% of adults and teenagers 16 and older, if they get vaccinated, at least have one, then he'll remove the mask mandate right there. But he's doing it, you know, gradually, but there is some light at the end of the tunnel.
And how close is Minnesota to that 65%?
Fairly close, at within about a 5 percentage points from what I understand. But of course, there's been the case in both Minnesota and North Dakota where the demand for the vaccine has slowed a bit. So they're trying to get that ramp back up.
And how does that 60-65% compare with how North Dakota is doing?
North Dakota is doing about the same, right around 65%, which is good. You know, North Dakota has, because they've opened up a lot of clinics now to walk in. You can walk in and get a vaccination instead of having to make an appointment.
Yeah, I know someone who had a scheduled shot in Oregon where she lives, but then was in this area at the same time that her second shot was due. And since she's from here, she has a permanent address here and was able to walk in and go get her second shot and then go back to Oregon.
Yes.
So North Dakota did loosen its restrictions a little bit earlier. Have we seen any uptick in cases since those restrictions were
loosened? You know, it's been very strange because a lot of the case uptick also depends on the number of, you know, tests people are getting. But the positive rate is still below 5% on that rolling 14-day average. So that's really pretty good. But, you know, it spikes up once in a while.
Yeah, we're at about 3.05% this week.
A little over 3%, exactly.
Okay. And there are, last time I checked the news page, anyway, two more deaths and 138 new cases.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. The Department of Public Instruction is monitoring ESSER funding for local schools. So set us up first, ESSER, Elementary Secondary School Emergency Relief.
Correct. Now it's
not so catchy.
That's right. Not so catchy. That's why they use ESSER as the acronym there. But that in the first COVID relief bill, there was a bit of money set aside for schools. Basically, how are you going to respond to the pandemic? Mm-hmm. Then there was a second, as I say, tranche of money. And now there's a third one that's going to be fairly large, and it's going to be dealing with some of the issues that have really cropped up, especially what they're talking about is learning fatigue, where people who are online may not be up to speed on a lot of things because a lot of learning takes place with human interaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so just hands-on. I'm thinking some of these lab classes, like some of the sciences especially.
That's right. And there is really a concern about that nationwide. And North Dakota's got some strategies, which include maybe catching people up longer school days, maybe fewer holidays, and maybe more just in-classroom instruction. So we'll watch this going forward. And the legislature, here's the thing that got a lot of people, you know, had to cock the eyebrow a little bit at saying legislature had no say on how schools can spend that money. But the federal government and the legislature is requiring the Department of Public Instruction to monitor how they are spending it. So it's on the back end.
And is the monitoring all self-reporting, or is it, you know, how do you really hold someone accountable for that?
What that is going to happen is that DPI is going to be getting surveys and having people fill out forms and things like that. You know, because it was not a one-size-fits-all, there's a certain disparity among what school districts are receiving, and it's based on your poverty rate. So there are some districts in North Dakota that are getting an awful lot of money and some that are getting virtually nothing.
Hmm. So, and those poverty rates, that's often established by, for example, the number of kids who are getting free and reduced price meals?
Exactly. And that's how the federal government is measuring it.
Okay. Is this one-time spending or ongoing?
This is all supposed to be one-time spending.
Okay.
That's another complication.
Yeah. What have you heard any of their ideas? I mean, you said longer school days, maybe fewer holidays, but have you heard anything a little bit more concrete?
Not too much. I know that plans are being developed, but here is one thing that I know a couple of school districts are looking at: extending the school year into June. Hmm. So that's a potential for some school districts.
Okay. There's been a change in water governance from the 2021 legislature.
And this is very interesting that they, instead of having a water commission and a water chief engineer, they've gone to a department with a department director and a chief engineer who will basically be on pretty much the same level, but the director will deal with the politics and the engineer will deal with the engineering, which is an interesting
concept. Two very different things.
It is two very different things, but it used to be that the state engineer would deal with both because you dealt with the commission, and the commission was appointed by the governor, and then he was dealing with how you get these projects accomplished. I think it's a fascinating look at how government is evolving, because you've got that, and then you've got, at the same time, human services and health are actually going to merge.
And when you talk about this water governance, are we talking about like how water is being used, or how, for example, does this have anything to do with flood infrastructure? Maybe how
mostly
water
flood
is being
infrastructure
controlled.
And also delivery of water to certain places. The people at the Water Commission will talk about the city of Benedict, which doesn't have a public works department, is getting a new supply of fresh water. And they're able to accomplish that through the Water Commission and the efforts of the state engineer. So now that's what the state engineer is going to be really focused on. So it's going to be how you get water to where it's needed and how do you help prevent flooding.
We have a couple of energy stories from this week. MDU and Great Plains natural gas rates are increasing. This was interim and now permanent. Is that correct?
That's correct. And it's actually a little bit higher than the interim rates that were that they were granted. And state law in North Dakota says you must grant interim rates if you're the Public Service Commission, that you have to have some extraordinary reasons not to grant them.
Mm. What are the causes for these rates going up?
A lot of it is infrastructure. A lot of piping that's in the ground is old and needs to be replaced. And also going from the main pipe into your home, some of that's going to be replaced too. That costs, and that's why the companies have come and said, we need more on this. There's going to be another thing that we'll have to watch what's going to happen over the next few months. Remember back in February with the cold spell, especially mm-hmm. in the southwestern part of the United States,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of natural gas supplies actually froze up because they weren't prepared for the cold weather. So a lot of natural gas came from our region. So that drove the price up. And they were talking, you know, pretty extensive price increases. Now, MDU and Xcel Energy are looking at ways to put that over several months so the impact is not going to be so severe all at once.
Otter Tail Power is installing automated metering. Why do they want to do this?
They want to do that because they, A, want to save money, B, get a better handle on what usage are, and C, if you are in a home and you have those smart thermostats, you might be able to save money because you can figure out where you're using it and maybe can, you know, balance it that way. And Otter Tail Power Company said it's going to save them over $40 million to do that.
Over how many years?
Oh, that's going to be over about 20 years.
Okay.
And what it is that you're not sending crews out to read meters in homes.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, the crews will be working on things like looking for gas main breaks and power lines that are, you know, need to be replaced.
Well, we check in with News Director Dave Thompson once a week to rehash the week's biggest stories, but we also want to talk with Dave. Do you want me to redo that? We check in with News Director Dave Thompson once a week to go beyond the headlines of the week's biggest stories. And Dave is also going to join me now and talk about...
How you should become a member of Prairie Public. Yes.
Right. It is the final Friday of our spring member drive, and you can call or text the word donate to 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. Conversations like this are so important for our listeners who don't just want the soundbite. They don't need to just know what happened. They need to know
some of the
why.
Context. Exactly.
Exactly why it happens, and even more importantly, how that impacts all of us.
Really, you want to go behind the headlines as much as you can. That's why we have the opportunity to do this on our Friday Main Streets, and also once a month when we have the Editors Roundtable or Journalists Roundtable.
Mm-hmm.
That gives us all a chance to, you know, explore stories in more depth so that people get more of a context of what's happening.
Well, that part of our mission statement, entertain, engage, and also inform our listeners. We want to keep people engaged and informed, enlightened, just connected with the world. Frankly, we want you to be able to speak intelligently about everything that is happening in the state. It is built into the mission of what we do at Prairie Public, and it is only possible because of member support.
Correct.
Call or text the word donate to 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. And Dave, today is an extra great day to do it, not just because it's the last official day
right.
of the drive, but
right.
because
we have that dollar for dollar match.
Yes.
And we want to, you know, get that dollar for dollar match because that all helps us pay the bills. We have bills like other stations do, but we cannot sell commercials. We do have underwriting announcements, and we appreciate them. But it is you who are listening, who are the biggest source of our financial support here at Prairie Public.
Yeah, we can't just reach out to the Public Service Commission and say, hey, we need an interim rate increase and then a permanent rate increase. That works for other industries. That's completely fine.
Not for us.
But that doesn't work for public radio. We are actually not allowed to sell advertising. And what we do instead is come to our listeners to make up that difference. You get to decide both how much this service means to you and what fits into your budget, whether you're giving a one-time gift or breaking that up into easy to manage monthly payments. You get to decide. But it starts with a simple process of making that donation online or by phone. Online is at prairiepublic.org, or you can call or text the word donate to 800-359-4145. For everything that you hear on Main Street, on Morning Edition, on All Things Considered, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, This American Life, Away With Words, Radio Lab. I could keep going,
yes,
people.
Yes.
Everything that you hear, it's possible because of you. 800-359-4145. Matt O'Lean is next.
I'm Bill Curtis. Every week, I open Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me with a pun on my name. While it may seem like fun and games to you, compulsive punning is a serious condition. But with your donation, scientists say they can find a cure. And I believe them. So please give to this NPR station so I can be free of this terrible curse.
Call 1-800-359-4145 or join us online at prairiepublic.org.
Well, there's the fanfare. It's time to have our in-house movie critic, Matt O'Lean, in studio with us to talk about the latest film that he has seen. This one is called I'm Thinking of Ending Things. It's a film, director Charlie Kaufman, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Being John Malkovich. Uh-huh. If you're familiar with those movies, you know they can be kind of a mind trip.
Yes, mind-bending is exactly what I think of with Charlie Kaufman. He wrote and directed this. It's based on a novel from 2016 by Ian Reid, who's a Canadian writer, and he has adapted this novel with kind of that Charlie Kaufman-esque spin that he put on the film's adaptation. As you mentioned, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Being John Malkovich. And so it's got all of the Charlie Kaufman tropes, endless conversation between actors and actresses. You're not sure what's going on. This was a film recommended to me all through 2020 by several of my movie friends who liked it. I just had not gotten around to seeing it. It did not get any Oscar love. It did get some love from some critics organizations, including the North Dakota Film Society, which nominated it for several awards. I'm a member of that group. The plot is two people that are dating. They've been dating about 6-7 months, although the woman, played by Jessie Buckley, isn't sure quite how long it is, and she's the narrator. She kind of narrates inside her head as she's driving in a car with Jesse Plemons, her boyfriend, to go visit his parents on a remote farm, and it's during a blizzard. And so
always a good idea.
The car ride seems to go on forever to try to get there, but the conversation is endlessly fascinating between these two actors. Jesse Buckley really gives the performance of the movie. She was so good in Wild Rose in 2019, which was about a British singer who wants to sing country music, and she was so good in that, and she's so good in this performance. Jesse Plemons, a little more underplaying. I almost view him as kind of the current Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's kind of got that kind of look to himself.
I was thinking that.
He's not a traditional leading man whatsoever, but he's a wonderful actor, and he underplays things very well. Once they get to the farmstead, things get strange, and that is where you're going to have to watch it and figure out what is going on. What is Jesse Buckley seeing? Is Jesse Buckley the reliable narrator? Is Jesse Plemons the reliable narrator? Who's the unreliable narrator in this whole this whole labyrinth of script that is going on. His parents are played by Toni Collette and David Thewlis. They're wonderful in their parts. But pretty much from that point on, it is impossible to talk about the plot because you're not sure what's going on. I did figure it out by the end what is going on, and it's heartbreaking. It is really ultimately a very moving film. I found it to be moving. I found the acting to be very good. It's strange. It's going to be the most polarizing movie that people will have seen in 2020. Some people love it. Some people absolutely can't stand it. In the end, I found it to be a moving film. But as it's going, you're not sure if you're watching a rom-com, a horror movie, or some kind of weird plot twist device that's leading you somewhere where you're not sure you're going. And even when you get there, what just happened? That's what people are saying when they see this movie. But ultimately, I liked it a lot. I think Jessie Buckley could have got into that best actress mix. She's so good in this performance. But it was a film that was pretty much, you know, only seen on Netflix. And even though that was eligible this year to be an Oscar film, you did not have to be in theaters. I still think a lot of people did not see this movie. And I continue to run into people who just didn't see a lot of movies in 2020, despite the COVID lockdown. And that's because they just weren't in theaters and people couldn't find exactly where they were streaming. But this is one I would recommend if you like strange movies, if you like to think, I'm Thinking of Ending Things is the movie to see. I won't tell you what the title means. You can take that a couple different ways, but you'll kind of figure it out within the first 10 minutes what that title means. But if you do watch it, be very careful. You need to pay attention to the dialogue. You need to really pay attention to what's going on. So commit 2 hours mentally. You can't just...
This isn't the Transformers. You can't just walk in.
In and out of the kitchen and come back. And, you know, you can't do that. It's going to require some thought and some focus.
Well, per usual, you've seen the movie. I've seen the trailer. But the parents seem not of this earth somehow.
No, they do not strike me as rural farm couple people. From what I would cast them... in this area, in this region. So, that's perfect for a Charlie Kaufman movie because David Thewlis speaks with a British accent and you're like, why is he playing his farmer father when he speaks like he's from Scotland or someplace? And Toni Collette is, you know, kind of plays this manic mother. But because we're watching a Charlie Kaufman movie, it all seems to make sense perfectly. We don't expect maybe the Minnesota farm couple that we're expecting at the end of this long blizzard drive.
Sure.
And there's little clues and hints along the way to let you know what is going on with both of these characters and what isn't going on with these characters.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating one, and I'm going to put that in my Netflix queue to watch. Thanks, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 7th. Steamboats have a storied history in North Dakota. Today we share a few steamboat tales. In 1832, the Yellowstone set a record voyage up the Missouri River by reaching Fort Union on the border of present-day Montana and North Dakota. In 1837, the St. Peter's spread a deadly wave of smallpox as it traveled the Missouri River. The epidemic all but destroyed the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara people. The first opinion of the Dakota Territorial Supreme Court in 1867 concerned whether the seizure of a steamboat had been proper. The crime involved was introducing into the Indian country spirituous and intoxicating liquors. In 1876, the Far West carried wounded soldiers and the news of Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer's annihilation. Bismarck Tribune editor Clement Lounsbury wrote lengthy dispatches about the episode for the New York Herald that took over 22 hours to transmit by telegraph, costing more than $3,000. In 1892, the Rosebud transported 170 quartzite monuments upriver from Pier, which would mark the borderline between North and South Dakota west of the Missouri River. Many of these pink-colored monuments still stand today. A remnant of the steamboat era stands over the Yellowstone River near Cartwright, North Dakota, the Fairview Lift Bridge. The bridge was completed in 1913. Its middle section could be raised and lowered to allow steamboats to pass. But the lift section was only raised once for a test. Railroads had made steamboats obsolete. For many years, the bridge served both trains and automobiles. Today, the Fairview Lift Bridge is a walking path that leads to the abandoned Cartwright Tunnel. Steamboat travel wasn't easy. The boats feasted on wood for fuel, and the Missouri River's muddy waters posed dangers such as sandbars and other snags. On this date in 1887, the Eclipse left Bismarck on its way upriver to Fort Benton in Montana Territory. But the next day, the boat struck a rock near Fort Berthold and broke a hole in her hull. Her stern sank in 12 feet of water, with her bow in the shallows. 18 inches of water filled the hold. The cargo was valued at $35,000. It was offloaded to shore, and another steamboat picked it up, but nearly $2,000 worth was lost. The Eclipse would eventually be raised and repaired and returned to Bismarck. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Ian Manuel was sentenced to life without parole at the age of 14 and spent 18 consecutive years in solitary confinement.
Most people go crazy and lose their minds under those circumstances.
His story of holding on to sanity, also what vaccine hesitancy means among police rank and file. The stories in all the news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
One last reminder this week for Main Street to let you know how you can support the programming that you rely on day in and day out. You can call or text the word donate to 800-359-4145 or click and join at prairiepublic.org. Listener members are the bulk of our revenue stream. It is what sets the stage for all that you hear from a show like today, where we had Jack Russell Weinstein, and then we had Dave and Matt, and earlier we've had poets and photographers, we've had authors, we have scientists, we have so many fascinating and engaging people day in and day out on Main Street. It's only possible because of membership support. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org. Coming up Monday on Main Street, Stephen Johnson is the author of Extra Life, A Short History of Living Longer. And this is going to be a PBS special. And we're going to learn all about it on Monday. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend. And thanks for your support.